all people believe what they believe mostly out of intuition or emotion or life experience rather than just sheer rational intellect. Mm-hmm. He uses the illustration of an elephant and a rider. You know, the elephant is like our emotions, our intuition, our gut feelings. And the rider on top of the elephant is like our rational reasoning, you know? And like, that elephant's going to go where it wants to go. If it wants to eat from that tree over there, did it eat trees? You know, it's going to go and you can try to persuade it or whatever. But like, you know, so that just was revolutionary to me.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future. Well, I've really been looking forward to the conversation we're having today. Preston Sprinkle is on the show, and Preston has got all kinds of things that he's up to. He's a biblical scholar. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He hosts an incredible podcast called Theology in the Raw, and he's the co-founder and president of the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender. Preston, it's so good to have you on the show.
It's good to be on, Brian. It's been a long time since we hung out, so it's good to see you again.
Good to see you as well. And I learned, since I last saw you, I learned an interesting piece of trivia about you, which is that one of your favorite beers is Dragon's Milk, made right here in West Michigan.
Yes, it is.
Is that still the case, or have you moved beyond Dragon's Milk?
I'm not even a big stout guy, but Dragon's Milk is just fantastic. I mean, it's a heavy beer. As you yeah. It's a slow sipper, but no, I would say it's probably my favorite beer. Yeah, it's incredible.
Do you get it in Boise, or like, I don't know if they have distribution that far, or is this like a...
I can find it in some stores, like a Whole Foods, maybe not. I don't think Trader Joe's carries it. I've only seen it on tap here maybe once, and okay. Even that, yeah, it's pretty rare. So
okay,
yeah, gotcha. That's why I got to travel out to Grand Rapids to get my West Michigan to get my Dragon's Milk.
How many podcasts have you opened by discussing your favorite beer? I'm guessing that number is fairly small.
Probably maybe less than a dozen, but it's not unheard of.
Okay.
on my podcast.
Well, we so appreciate your leadership and ministry, and our church has benefited so much from your books, your podcast, for everything that's published on the center's website. But before we get to some of those things, I would love for you to share a little bit of your journey of how you got to where you are today. Part of our hope in this, in our podcast, is to help people who are discerning calling and also when it comes to leading forward, kind of understanding and appreciating some of the practical steps that it takes to make that happen. So you've done a lot by now and have accomplished a lot by the grace of God. But even kind of rewinding, how'd you even know you were going to land in academia in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll try to keep an eye on the ultimate question you're wanting to wrestle with your audience. That's a great way to frame it. And I'll try to be as concise as I can, became a Christian at 19. Before being a Christian, I hated school, hated academics, didn't read a book till I was 17 years old, from cover to cover. So not naturally wired this way at all, but almost overnight, when I became a Christian, God placed this strange spark inside my soul to just want to study the Bible like crazy. And so I just could not get enough. Like I almost use the term addicted to studying the Bible.
Wow. You know?
And I don't say that like some people praise it. Like it was to a fault. Like I was avoiding people, wasn't doing other things because I just wanted to study the Bible. And then, you know, early on, especially there's a pride element there. You know, you go to a Christian college and I want to be, you know, more biblically astute than everybody else because I wanted to be, you know, yeah, be able to like win an argument. So there's all kinds of weird, sinister, sinful, you know, things that could be wrapped up in that. But yeah, I just fell in love with studying the Bible. So that led me to
do. You were part of a Christian home or not?
Sort of. Yeah. My dad left when I was 10. And he's not a believer. My mom is. But I wasn't like, I didn't really go to youth group. My mom would force me to sometimes, but it wasn't really plugged in. So I attended a church, you know, and called myself a Christian, but it definitely wasn't acting like it. So yeah, when I decided to truly follow Jesus at 19, just fell in love with studying the Bible. I couldn't get enough of it. And I really wanted to know why I believed what I believed. So even kind of that comes out of my podcast, even now and the books I write, like, you know, me being inquisitive about what does the Bible actually say about this topic or that topic, like that was birthed in me from the very beginning. Like I just, yeah, I wasn't, was never settled with somebody kind of spoon feeding me the right answer. Like, I just have a natural kind of like, well, why do we believe that? Or sure. What about this? What about that? What is somebody that disagrees with that answer? What would they say? Like, I remember, you know, in seminary, which, you know, we would always read books that lined up with what our seminary teaches, and wouldn't read books by alternative viewpoints. And I was like, well, what does somebody else believe? You know, we went to, I was a very dispensational, you know, John MacArthur's seminary, so very dispensational. And I was like, well, I don't know. I don't think John Calvin is dispensational, and we like him. So, like, what's the other non-dispensational view? So I remember one time waking up at 3:30 in the morning because I had class at like 6, and I had to, you know, so I had to wake up at 3:30 to like read an essay by a covenant theologian, you know, and say, well, where do they get there from the Bible? You know? So anyway, all that to say, my entire Christian journey since then has been one of trying to figure out what does the Bible say, and let the chips fall where they may too. You know, like, I never wanted to believe something because the masses around me believe that. Like, I wanted to believe something because it's truly rooted in what the Bible teaches. So, yeah, that spirit, I think, hopefully, is stayed with me the whole time.
Yeah, I think one, it just comes out in how you think and how you process, which really helps as fellow searchers and question askers. You can resonate with your spirit and heart because you feel like you're a guy who comes to the conversation not with, I already know the right answer, and I'm looking for, you know, whatever it's going to take to bolster my answer and defend against other views, but rather I'm really searching out for what's true and what's faithful to the text. Did you know early on then that you wanted to go into higher education and that kind of thing? I know you spent some time teaching and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah, early on, I just, I think I didn't know what I just loved studying the Bible. And then early on, someone said, well, you know, you can get paid to, you know, teach the Bible, like be a pastor or something, you know, I'm like, I don't know if I want to be a pastor, but that sounds awesome. Like, I can actually get paid to teach the Bible and then say, well, you can go teach at a Christian college, you know? So I said, all right, what do I need to do that? You know? And they said, well, you need to get all these degrees. And I'm like, great, sign me up, you know? So yeah, higher education was just an absolute joy. Like, I just loved it. And yeah, I got my PhD in New Testament from Aberdeen University in 2007. Got a job teaching the Bible at Cedarville University right after, and just I was a kid in a candy store. I mean, waking up every day to study the Bible in order to teach the Bible to people paying to learn the Bible, you know?
Yeah. So
you know, most of them at least wanted to be there. So yeah, from early on in my Christian journey, I wanted to be in Christian academia. So what I'm doing now, and I'm sure we'll get to that, like I thought I'd just be in a Christian classroom for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just absolutely loved it. And, didn't know any different, really.
What actually led to the shift then? I know that you end up co-founding the center, but was it straight from teaching college classes to founding the center, or how'd the journey look?
Yeah, sort of. I was, taught 2 years at Cedarville University in Ohio, and then moved to Eternity Bible College in California, taught there for 5 years. And then around 2013, 2014, and I'll say the details are boring, but my family moved to Boise, Idaho to plant an extension campus for Eternity Bible College. It would have been our first campus outside of California. Mm-hmm. And we tried that for a couple of years, but it just didn't take off. I had like 11 students, which wasn't paying the bills. And by then I was kind of like, I was getting, well, okay. So that was like 2014, 2015. 2015, 2016. So I had written a book called People to Be Loved. It was on What Does the Bible Say About Homosexuality? And that got a decent amount of traction. It was, I think a lot of, especially church leaders who read the book said, man, this is kind of validating how I was feeling.
Yeah, great book.
I don't hate gay people. I want to love gay people, but when I read the Bible, I just don't see same-sex marriage in there. So how can I be gracious and also be truthful to scripture? And that was kind of where I was at. And that, so that book, I think struck a nerve, a niche maybe.
Yeah.
And so I was getting invited to do more speaking and pastoral training and stuff. So, but I had a day job, you know, trying to plant a campus, but I had this other thing going on that to me was seemed much more important to the kingdom and more fruitful. And I was really enjoying it. So after a couple of years trying to get the campus going, when it just didn't get off the ground, I told my board, I said, I think I need to move on and do something else. And almost immediately, It was Claire DeGraff. You know Claire,
I
right?
do, yeah, in, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So he got a hold of my stuff, and he reached out to me almost around the same time. And when he heard that I basically had lost or quit my job, he says, well, let me fly you out to Grand Rapids, because I think what you're doing with the sexuality conversation, if you can find a way to make a living off this, would you want to do that full time? I said, yeah, I would love to do that. So he helped me create the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender. And
no kidding.
Yeah, within the next year, that was so we started officially in January 2017.
Okay.
I think I must have spoke at your church maybe a year later. Like, it was pretty early on.
Yeah, that must have been very front end then.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of my early speaking was in Grand Rapids because he had all these connections and stuff. Right. So, yeah.
So was when we read co-founder, for example, on the center's website, is Claire viewed as then the other founder? Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Claire's the other founder. I would say my wife and I both founded it with Claire. She's a lot more. I mean, she like runs the thing now. Early on, she did more admin stuff. You know, it was very much a mom and pop. It still isn't, anyways. You know, organization. Now we have a few more employees and stuff. But Claire would be the co-founder.
It's really cool to hear you share. Sometimes I think people can look at someone like you and think, oh, he's publishing these books and he's doing these great things and he travels around and he's got the podcast and all this. And to think that really a lot of this came to pass because of one opportunity that closed that didn't end well. And just a good, great kind of takeaway to think about God using what in some ways could look like this failed, you know, and it's right. And it's okay. This didn't work out the way we expected. And so let's honor that. Let's call it what it is. And you had the courage to say it's time to move on and all that. And that ultimately paved the way for a new thing to come to life that has done so much good. Now, when it comes to leading the center, and I don't know between your wife and others, I don't know how much you have to get kind of involved with operational and strategic leadership, or how much you're able to just kind of you're flying at 30,000 and speaking and writing and whatnot. What's the leadership journey been like? I mean, do you enjoy the leadership part of it, or does it feel like the leadership part's the hard part and you'd rather just be writing, or how's that work?
I don't enjoy the leadership. This sounds so bad, man. But I'm, you ask me an honest question, I'll give you an honest answer. Yeah. I don't enjoy the leadership. I think early on, I desired to be kind of in a leadership role. Mm-hmm. And I kept feeling kind of exhausted because I don't feel like I'm naturally wired for what I would call like a traditional leadership role, you know, running a meeting and mentoring, you know, the people that are working for me and really casting, I would say casting vision and dreaming about different things. I do like that in collaboration. I wouldn't want to do it by myself, but both my wife and I, we have other employees and stuff that we talk through things. But in terms of like, leading other people in this kind of like really intentional discipleship, like I do that to some extent. I need to, because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not natural. People are, you know, the people, I mean, you may be like, people are just born with that kind of like, they're just so good at it. I think like a John Tyson or, I don't know why he just came to mind, but there's people that I know that are just so good at that kind of leadership. So yeah, for me, I like, if the term thought leader fits, then I do love, that's where my leadership, where I thrive in terms of leadership, helping people think well through various issues, you know, whatever that looks like, you know. So really the podcast, my podcast is one of the favorite things I do, talking to people and doing what you're doing, you know, having conversations with people in a way that can kind of help other people who are listening on. So
it's interesting hearing you talk. A friend of mine once said there are pastors who lead so they can teach, and then there are pastors who teach so they can lead. And I feel like the leadership you're doing is really, you know, it's part of what comes with your overall ministry calling, but it really is to help you enables you to do the things that you're really probably most passionate about and most gifted for. And just, you know, I just feel like the center has done so, so very much good. Give us, if you could, I'm even based on what you said, some of your writing and communication and being a thought leader, some of the joys of it, when it comes to, and you spoke to this a little bit, that when it comes to some of the things that you go, and here's the hard part, like if we're just going to peel back the curtain, you know, once in a while I'll get an email from the center, for example, about some fundraising or something like that. How much you're involved with those kinds of things. But when you think about, here's the tough part of just being a leader, doing what I do, being the head of this organization, what are those kinds of things?
There's many challenges. One of the ones that's not easy, but I do have a certain level of resilience, it's just all the attacks and accusations, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially, you know, I could stir stuff up. I know it. I push envelopes. So I mean, I put myself out there on challenging topics, and so I'm gonna get criticized, sometimes really ruthlessly, you know, criticized. The difference, which I feel like your job's harder than mine, because you have physical people under your care where you get the criticism from, you know. For me, it's just usually like names and faces on social media that I've never met, never will meet. Mm-hmm. It's the majority of them, you know. So it's more of like digital criticism, which you know, it still affects me, but I do feel like I've got I'm fairly resilient to it.
Have you always been that way? I mean, it's funny because on the one hand, I was thinking about your Enneagram number. You're an Enneagram 1, right? Which is the...
I think so. That's what I've been tested as, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I am too, perfectionist, although I always prefer the term reformer, which sounds much better. But in any case, you're sitting...
No one likes a perfectionist.
No, exactly. But you're diving into... You've got this bent for controversial and hot button issues that just invite not just critique, but I mean probably the hottest kinds of critique and opinions. And so when I think about that in conjunction with being someone who like the perfectionist side of things, that person generally, they want to do it right. They want to, you know, the worst thing they can imagine is failing. And you're like jumping into conversations that a bunch of people are going to think you're passionately failing all the time. Has that ability to receive that kind of critique and criticism been something that you've grown in, or have you always been someone who can just generally speaking take it and not be overly affected by it?
I think it's a both and. There are weird aspects to my personality that I can trace back to as long as I go. I mean, I'm the kid that when my mom told me that my dad was leaving, it didn't really bother me, and I wasn't super close to my dad, but he was a fine dad, you know, wasn't, you know, and it just, even to this day, like people's like, you still have daddy issues, you need to go. I'm like, maybe I do. I don't know. I've talked to therapists and counselors, and the most recent conversation I had with the therapist, she's kind of dug. She's like, I think you're kind of good. Like, other things in life really bothered me. Like when I was playing baseball through college, and that perfectionist came out where if I wasn't batting 1,000, I was, you know, I was depressed and angry at myself, you know, which is, it's a bad sport to be in as a perfectionist, because you know, hitting 300 is good, and that's like you're failing 7 out of 10 times. There are certain things in life just didn't bother me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And so there's times when I'll stare at a 1-star review of my podcast or read something on social media where somebody's, you know, yelling and screaming at me or whatever. And it just doesn't really bother me.
Yeah.
But I say that, but I mean, you know, 1, 2, 5, 10 critiques, like, you know, they're, but you know, 50, 100 or some of the more personal ones, mm-hmm. The worst one for me, here's where it's really hard, is when people, misrepresent what I actually say and then critique me. That is so hard. I'm like, you want to call me a heretic summarizing my beliefs accurately, I honestly have no problem with that. But when you say you believe this and therefore, I'm like, I don't believe that. So stop saying that. Like, misrepresentation is the one that really is hard for me. Overall, like it hasn't been easy. I mean, you asked, you know, what's been the most challenging. This is, you know, what I mentioned. Yeah. So it's challenging, but for how much I've endured, it hasn't. People tell me, like, if they people that see all the criticism I get, they said, if I got through that, I would be in, you know, in a shivered, shriveled up in a fetal position.
I couldn't do it, man.
I mean, I do go to the gym and work out pretty hard. I chop wood, and, you know, sometimes.
Same.
Am I right to say, as a pastor, I mean, you get criticism, I'm sure, and it's from people that you know face to face. You've been to their homes, they've been to your home. Sometimes you've probably spent, you know, meals together in relationship, and then all of a sudden you'll get an email and you're like, what? Like,
yeah, you know, I would say, and this is, I don't know why this is the case, but I would say, on the balance, I don't get that much, you know, when people do reach out, generally, it's more of a thoughtful question that's exploring and less lighting me up, so to speak. That's what I would call the kind of criticism you're talking about. Is like, wow, I just felt like I got lit up. Now, I will say the thing that is absolutely tough in pastoral ministry for me is less, because I just don't get that many, wow, that was a tough email kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But what I do get is when you hear somebody stepped away from the church for whatever reason. And I do deeply believe, let's hold loosely, these are not my people, so to speak. These are Christ's people, and it's Christ's church. And so I always want to have an atmosphere of, or an attitude rather, of celebrating when someone moves on for a good reason, you know, that they, whatever reason it is. But when you have been, to your point, when you've been in their homes, when you have had very significant, I mean, incredibly powerful pastoral moments, sometimes in the times of greatest suffering that they've ever experienced in their lives. And then after walking through those things, you hear a couple of years later, I mean, like children passing away, and then you hear a couple of years later, yeah, they've decided that such and such church is going to be a better fit for them. You know, I'm not angry. Any of that. I'm not defensive. It just kind of is sad. You know, it's a grieving thing. And some folks are really good about communication with saying, hey, we wanted you to know, and I just so appreciate this. So, you know, we wanted you to know, we feel like God's calling us to this church. Here's why. So appreciate your ministry and leadership, your role in our lives. And boy, that is so nice when people have that kind of an approach. Other times it's, I just heard, oh yeah, so-and-so, they left like 6 months ago. You go, all right. Well, that's the way it goes then. So anyway.
I wonder if it is because people see you face-to-face. So they know if, I think that tempers probably people's like criticism, you know, like it's a lot harder to, when they, obviously they hear you.
100%.
On stage, they know he's a person. Yeah. They see your family and kids and friends, you know, they know you as a human being, and it's a lot harder to offer that ruthless criticism to an actual human being. But when you're just a name and a face on a podcast or something, or I write a book, you know, that's where all the dehumanization comes out.
That's
and
right.
I do want to be clear, for every criticism I get, you know, 50 positive things. So and maybe that's what does help me get through it too. Mm-hmm. It's like, if I was only getting the criticism, I might say, maybe I'm doing something really wrong, but because I get so much, you know, people, especially with sexuality. I mean, again, that's a very volatile area, and the criticism I get can be really aggressive. But man, I've just seen so many amazing things happen in God's kingdom in that conversation.
Yeah,
that's just, you can't put a price tag on that.
How do you? And I want to move into the specific that conversation in just a minute. But let me just ask one more question on the criticism side of things. How do you discern, considering that you do have such a platform that invites criticism because so much, you do so much online, how do you discern what you're going to respond to, what not? I saw you did an episode recently that, you know, it must have been, you had this guy that said some stuff that's just, one, he mischaracterizes your views and then takes you to task for all of his mischaracterizations. So it's rare though for you to say, okay, we need to have, we're going to get after this. So how do you decide this is the one I'm going to engage on, or this is the post, or this is the piece of feedback?
Well, that one was a one-off. I've done over 1,200 episodes. That was the first time I've ever done anything like that, and I probably will never do that again. So, that's a good question. Most of the criticism is so either, it is going to sound, I'll just say it and you can correct me later. It's most of the criticism I see online is just so thoughtless, or it's not made in good faith that I just don't, it's a 50 word tweet. It's a, you know, post on whatever, like the social, it's not long form, you know, rarely do I have like somebody write like a lengthy, thoughtful critical blog post or something where they summarize my views accurately. They highlight maybe some good things and then offer some criticism, even if it's really severe criticism. Those kind of things, I it's sad, but that's like very rare for that to happen. Even with those, I have to be selective because I just, it's a time issue too, you know? And I've tried to shield myself too. Like, I don't Google my name. You know, I don't typically read like Amazon reviews. It's just the kind of like the low hanging where somebody just, all they need is an internet connection and a social media account that gives them access to critique, you know?
Right.
That, to sort through all the weird stuff that's just going to make me angry, to find, you know, the one that's, you know, I just don't do that. So it has to kind of come to me, or I have to kind of go search it out. Or somebody might say, hey, I read this thing. It was a really good, thoughtful criticism. You might want to consider it. I'm happy. I actually love, in a weird way, I love critical feedback. Like, I, because I genuinely don't, I want to find the truth. And if I want to identify the areas of my life that I'm believing, things that I believe that aren't true, because we're all imperfect. So somewhere there's stuff that needs to be critiqued. So I genuinely want to correct that. So
yeah, that's
like, there was one, I remember Matthew Vines, he's an affirming gay Christian. Like, he wrote a pretty, it was a video, I think he recorded it, but it's also a transcript, a critique of me and my work. And I thought it was very thoughtful. It was very thoughtful. A couple of things I actually agree. He's like, oh, that point you read is pretty good. So I actually said, I need to adjust how I'm wording this, because I think you point out some things that the way I'm framing it's wrong, you know. Other things I thought he was wrong or misrepresenting either me, you know. But it was I think it was made in good faith. I think it was very thoughtful, you know. So I took a whole week, actually. It took several, you know, 20 hours to construct a very lengthy blog response, you know, send it to people to review it, make sure my language. So anyway, so every now and then I do that, but that's pretty rare. It has to be a really thoughtful, good faith criticism for me to do that.
Well, those are some good tips for anybody who's going to deal with critique or feedback. I love what you're saying about, don't just kind of read it all and take it all in. And if there's a way to have a filter, maybe it's somebody else reads before. Every year we do a all church survey where we have an open question. And that I will say that is one place where I'll have folks read it ahead of time, because if anybody just says stuff that you go, that's just mean, I don't even want to read it. So I'll have them purge that before. I'm with you. If it's growth inducing and comes from a fair-minded place, I want to hear it. It's not about it being hard to read. It's if it's just mean or attacking or whatever. And in all humility, particularly in my younger years, I've written a few of those. And so I don't judge anybody, because I've been that guy, and I don't want to be that guy again, but I also don't want to read that guy.
There's a proverb, right? Don't listen. The king should not listen to what all his servants are saying, lest he curse you behind your back. I am butchering it, but it's advice to, don't just go looking for every possible criticism that exists out there. Don't listen too closely to what everybody's saying, you know? And also, I guess for leaders listening on, I've had to learn this, like, it's a small percentage of people you're leading that give any kind of feedback. And even a smaller percentage that will give critiques, not critical feedback, but like criticism, so you may get one criticism that represents how 2% of the people you're leading even think. Just because it's, you know, you ask for feedback and you get 10 responses and maybe 3 are critical, and you feel like this represents a good portion of how people are feeling. Oftentimes it's just the one who was the loudest, or, you know, this is where I try to listen to critical feedback that in a sense is representing a decent portion of people. That, like, so the podcast I do, I often get, you know, try to get feedback like, hey, what do you guys think about this episode, that episode? And if I get several people that kind of say the same thing, like, yeah, you were kind of a jerk in that one, or yeah, you probably shouldn't have, that guest was just, you didn't push back in that. Like, if it's a one-off critique, then I kind of weigh it with a grain of salt. But if it's several people that are saying the same thing, then that's what I want to listen to.
Yeah, that's so good. And really, you model that right in the intro. I believe it's the intro to I think it's your newest book, Does the Bible Support Same-Sex Marriage? 21 Conversations from a Historically Christian View. One of the things you say right off the bat in the book is, I had several of my friends from different perspectives read this book and give me feedback on how I could write it better, how I could be more sensitive. That to me, what I hear you saying is, I want to humble myself before good input and good critique. I want to learn from others. I want to even invite that proactively. I'm not even just going to wait for it. I'm going to go seek it out. I'm just going to be careful about who I seek it out from and what I invite into my life. I love this book, and it's been so good. I've read several of your books, but what's a particular strength of this book is you need to, in other places, go to the level of depth that you do, but it's just fair to say that a lot of people are not ready or feel the motivation, I'll say, to go at the level of depth that some of your other work does. Whereas this book really, it goes to significant depth still. It's not like it's superficial, but it's very accessible for just the ordinary reader who's engaged in conversations. And so, one, just great job on the book, and I hope it's a tremendous tool for many. I know we're already just handing it out and making it available to folks. One of the things that's interesting, so it's the subtitle, 21 Conversations from a Historically Christian View. And before you get to any of the conversations, you lay down two foundations. And I think people would be surprised by what the first foundation is, but I absolutely loved it so much. I even loved it additionally, not because of just sexuality conversations, but actually with an election coming, I thought there was a lot of
politics. I was going to say politics. Yeah.
So, foundation number one, how to have a fruitful conversation. Yeah. And of all of the topics, now, foundation number two talks about a historically Christian view of marriage, and some might have said, it feels like that should be foundation one. Why do you start with fruitful conversations as foundation number one?
I'm so glad that was my favorite chapter. Honestly, like because everything else I say in the book, I've probably said somewhere elsewhere, either in a chapter or another book or a message I gave, or, you know, so a lot of that was me just kind of pulling together, you know, what I already feel like I have down pretty well. But that first chapter was honestly me summarizing what I've learned in living in this really intense place of talking about sexuality, you know, when people are coming from different angles and everything. So it was a time when I could actually put down for the first time ever, you know, like here's some things we should think through. So yeah, I'm glad you like it. Yeah, I put it first. I mean, I could have put I do think it kind of is a prelude to how to even engage in this conversation and other tough conversations. So even before we look at what is the historically Christian view of marriage and sexuality, even before we do that, I want to make sure we're coming to even that question from the right posture, because somebody could, and I've gotten this criticism, you know, the people wanted the book to be more, I almost want to say like angry or like, you know, like you need to argue and
more polemical. And yeah.
More polemical. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. More polemical. Like, you know, pointing out how stupid these arguments are, you know, so my tone is not tried to not be that at all.
Right.
So I think people needed to know early on from the very beginning, why the tone is just going to feel different, you know?
If you had to summarize, Preston, just to summarize how to have a fruitful conversation, and I really hope that even us talking a little bit here just motivates people to get the book. Yeah. But explain, let's explain even just on the science side of things, why our approach matters so much when it comes to persuasion.
One of the most important books I've ever read is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Disagree on Politics and Religion by secular psychologist Jonathan Haidt. Yeah, top five most important books ever read. What he argues in that book, not to argue, but what he shows in the book is that all people believe what they believe mostly out of intuition or emotion or life experience rather than just sheer rational intellect. He uses the illustration of an elephant and a rider. You know, the elephant is like our emotions, our intuition, our gut feelings. And the rider on top of the elephant is like a rational reasoning, you know? And like, that elephant's going to go where it wants to go. If it wants to eat from that tree over there, do they eat trees? I don't, you know, it's going to go, and you can try to persuade it or whatever, but like, you know, so that just was revolutionary to me, because I'm very rational, you know, and I think, oh, if I just supply superior rational evidence, then this person will be convinced of the correct viewpoint. And what he shows, and what many psychologists since then have shown, is like, that's just not why people believe what they believe,
right?
You know, so if that's not true, then simply trying to persuade people just with rational arguments is just not enough. Your tone matters a ton. If you show, you know, I talk about in the book, I give several illustrations, like showing genuine curiosity in another person's viewpoint that you fundamentally disagree with, that will do much more than simply rebuking them for believing that. You know, mm-hmm. politics, you know, and let's just play neutral here. You know, if your family is very pro-Trump, like they walk around the MAGA hats, and you are so anti-Trump, you will never get anywhere with them, or flip it around. Okay, I'm not,
sure. Yeah.
Your position is irrelevant right now. Whether you're pro-Trump or anti-Trump, whatever, like whichever side on that very volatile question you land, as counterintuitive and as difficult as it might be, if you show genuine curiosity in their viewpoint, that will do much more in helping that person consider an alternative viewpoint than if you just come out and show them factually why their viewpoint is wrong. So being a good listener, genuinely listening, being genuinely curious, finding points of agreement. So for your audience, if you have somebody out there who's, let's just say, is so anti-Trump or anti-Biden, whatever, like, is there anything in Trump or Biden that you could find agreement on?
Yeah.
You should, hopefully, you know, a broken clock.
Yeah, right twice a day.
You know, like they're created in God's image or something you could find. That will do way more to help somebody reconsider the viewpoint than if you just categorically say, that's just, how could you believe that? You know, and you just rail on them for believing it. So yeah. And I've learned that just anecdotally over the years. Mm-hmm. Like I rarely change people's minds on sexuality, you know, simply by giving them rational arguments. But when I show compassion, humility, when I don't demonstrate 100% certainty, when I show humility, when I affirm aspects of their viewpoint that I disagree with, but I would agree with maybe certain aspects and say, hey, man, yeah, this point you made is actually really, really, really good. Like that just lowers these emotional walls that people have and helps them to consider alternative viewpoints. So have you found that to be true as a path? I mean, because this is the world you live in too. Yeah, you live in the world of convincing people to think differently and live differently. And
yeah. And I love starting. And you know what, the key thing too, what you're saying is, you mentioned being an image bearer. It's really important for people to understand what you're talking about. This is not, hey, here are five ways you can manipulate a conversation so that the person will listen to you. This is, you're interacting with an image bearer of God.
Yeah.
And ultimately, everything you just described, it strikes me, these are profoundly scriptural principles that come out of the fruit of the Spirit when it comes to interacting with another human being. So yeah, just I think important to say that so nobody would think, oh man, they're just trying to figure out how they can change people's minds. No. We're trying to figure out how our conversation can reflect the tone of Christ to that person. And when I do that, to your question, when I start with an attitude of humility and seeking first to understand versus being understood, and I'm willing to affirm places where I see in them that I can celebrate their views or celebrate something in their life, it creates a connection that puts us on the same ground at some level.
Right. And we see this, I used the illustration in the book, we see this in Paul's letters, like his rhetorical method of persuasion differs from letter to letter. Mm-hmm. You know, he just rebukes the Galatians, you know, and then he, Corinthians, he's kind of uses some sarcasm sometimes, some, you know, other times he rebukes them, other times he kind of meets them where they're at. And then with Philemon, the illustration I use, like he really pulls back. He never says, I'm an apostle, you need to do this. You know, he really just is way like, holds his cards close, you know, and wants Philemon to come to the knowledge of the truth on his own rather than saying, I'm an apostle, you better do what I say.
Right.
So Paul, the point is, Paul was very aware of the rhetorical methods of his day and utilize those in his various letters. So, but what you said is the main point, like, you know, this is just the fruit of the Spirit that we're trying to demonstrate in how we converse with people.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to be recommending the book a lot, and for matters that speak to sexuality, but I really believe going into this election season, I read that chapter and I thought, because I've read some of those same books that informed your writing of that chapter, and I thought, I have got to figure out how I can work this in a message, in preparation for election season. I really want us to, as a church, and I don't just mean in Getty, I mean as a broader church, I really would love to see us do this election cycle better than last time it was as tough as it was. So I'm curious, you've got 21 conversations, and I think probably more than literally any person I know you're involved with these kinds of conversations pretty regularly. What would you say for the average person you talk with of all of the 21, and I can't actually reference them here because I've got my iPad in front of me, which also has the book on it. Yeah. But what would you say the top three that you deal with? I just want to whet people's appetite a little bit for this is what he's covering in the book.
That's good. Yeah. So it is worded a bit. Well, it's worded softly, 21 conversations. At the heart of it, it is me responding to the top 21 arguments for same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. So whenever I give a talk during the Q&A, I always get, well, what about this? What about that? Well, I heard this and I read a book and, has a Bible, I heard the Bible's been mistranslated, is it by a bunch of homophobic modern interpreters and the original Greek doesn't have these words or isn't it like, yeah. So that's what I'm doing in the book. And I do try to make it scholarly, responsible, but also very conversational. I didn't want this to be just for scholars. So, I would say one of the biggest ones has to do with, isn't this like a justice issue? Isn't the traditional view of marriage intrinsically like homophobic? Mm. Isn't it unloving to tell somebody they can't love who they are, it might be framed, born to love? Or as one of my chapters is, if God, made people gay, then why would he say it's not okay, to act on it? God made me this way. I was born this way. Then God's going to turn the same creator who made me like this is going to turn around and say, well, don't act on it. Like that doesn't make any sense. That's probably one of the biggest ones. And that kind of feeds over into, it just feels unjust.
Yeah.
In a post, civil rights era, where various people groups were dehumanized, like this seems to be kind of doing the same thing. Isn't this like akin to racism? Another one, it's kind of related, is isn't the traditional view of marriage intrinsically harmful to gay people? Like if somebody is gay and they come to Christ and they hear like, oh, but you can't marry a same-sex partner, isn't that going to produce all kinds of depression and anxiety and suicidality, even like isn't the psychological response that people are going to have to this, doesn't that show that this viewpoint is intrinsically harmful? One of the main biblical arguments that people use is they assume that adult consenting same-sex couples didn't exist in the ancient world. Right. So whatever Paul and other authors were saying no to, it wasn't what we're talking about today. We're talking about two people who love Jesus, are same-sex attracted, and they're not even having sex before marriage or whatever, but they have this, same social status, and they're want to enter into this covenant of love together. In the ancient world, they would say, oh, that didn't exist. It was a bunch of older men having sex with teenage boys, or it was rape or prostitution, same-sex rape, same-sex prostitution. So the category of relationship we're talking about today, that didn't exist in the ancient world. So whatever Paul's talking about wasn't what we're talking about. So, and I'm not going to answer that because people need to go read it. My response would take longer than, the few minutes we have.
But, that's the tough thing about it. And that's why it's great to hit some of these questions. And I really, really hope that's just bringing them up. If someone's listening right now and they go, I've wondered those same things, or I've heard those same things. And I can tell you as a pastor, every one of the questions or issues you just raised, I have heard multiple times over. Yeah. And so I think you're just right on point. Now, we got two questions that are kind of probably going to be flip sides of the same question. When I think of some friends I know who, when it comes to this whole conversation, go, why even engage? Yeah. It's so contentious. It's so heated. it's so prone to hurt and this kind of misunderstanding, all kinds of things. The language changes all the time. What am I supposed to say? How am I supposed to say it? Mm-hmm. Why would you say a Christian should be open to, and I don't know, maybe you'd even say seek out participating in conversations such as these?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I would say, don't get over your skis on what you know. So if you feel ill-equipped, you don't know really why you believe what you believe. You read the verses and it seems to say what it is. So you don't know what all the hubbub's about. I would not wander into kind of debate or whatever, somebody that does maybe know more than you do. Cause that can not be a fun experience.
For them or for you.
Yeah, exactly. And most people I know who confess Jesus, who also affirm same-sex marriage, they're really sharp. They're very well read. Mm-hmm. You don't just fall into that position. Typically, you've read some books that have argued that, you've thought through it, you've wrestled with it, you know. So yeah, don't wander into that kind of like debate unprepared. So my first advice would be, you know, this is a significant enough issue to prepare read some books, to think through it, to talk to people, and learn with curiosity and humility. And if someone said, well, why do I even need to do that? Here's what I would say to that is, look, questions around sexuality and gender have become some of the most pressing ethical questions facing the church today. So I do think it's kind of part of our discipleship responsibility to know not just what we believe, but why we believe it, especially when these questions are, I mean, they're pervasive in our culture, right? I don't need to argue for that. That's pretty well known. I mean, when you're in public and you meet somebody and they hear you're a Christian, it's you know, most cases it's going to come up. Well, yeah, I heard the Bible's anti-gay. So what do you think about that? You know, like, so I think it's, there's significant enough questions, especially now, that to say, I'm just not going to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying every single person needs to read 15 books on it, become an expert, but to be, again, to know why you believe what you believe, I think is really important. I often say the strength of our passion toward a certain subject should match the depth of our study in that topic.
That's good.
So if you're like, no, this is what I believe, and I'm just not going to really think through it, then I'm like, okay, at least admit that, though.
Yeah.
At least have the humility to say, hey, this is what my church believes. This is what Christianity believes. I'm a Christian. And honestly, I don't know exactly why I couldn't respond to anything. At least hold your view a bit lightly then, if you haven't taken the time to, you know, study it in more detail. Otherwise, it just looks like you're blindly following somebody else's, you know, beliefs without thinking through it. That's just not it. That just doesn't make Christianity look good.
Would you encourage people to, what I hear you saying is be prepared. And that's why, in fact, I wanted to talk about this on Made to Advance, because I don't think you can really advance well in life and culture without having some grasp of just biblical sexuality, particularly in the culture that we live. Would you say that, would you encourage folks to proactively engage on that conversation? That is to say, you know, you hear people talking and you kind of like, what I heard you saying is, if somebody kind of comes at you because you're a Christian or you take the view, be ready for that, how to engage intelligently.
Yeah.
Would you encourage people to proactively step in, or do you go, eh, maybe not so much? Maybe it's an as the Spirit leads kind of a thing.
I mean, every situation is different, so I don't want to give a blanket statement, but I probably wouldn't proactively assert what I believe about sexuality in a context where somebody's not asking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. I'm not saying it categorically. Maybe there's certain situations where I would. I guess to the person that maybe is like, man, I know some things. I know the verses and I've thought through them, but I'm no expert, you know. I would encourage that person to ask a lot of questions if they find themselves in a conversation with somebody who disagrees and clearly has, you know, knows a lot. There's no shame in saying, and this goes back to chapter one, right? I mean, show curiosity in what they believe. Why do you believe that? And just, that doesn't mean you lack conviction if you don't like win the argument. But I mean, part of your journey, a wise part of your journey, is truly understanding the other viewpoint that you don't agree with, you know, like, So don't feel like you need to like win the argument, convince somebody, or be able to defend your position, you know, in an airtight way. Be a curious learner and learn from them. I did that early on. I tried to, and I made the mistake early on of like, before I really studied it, I was in the middle of kind of studying it, you know, and I was like, well, what about, you know, like kind of, I was more argumentative, and then people kept raising points. I'm like, oh, I haven't thought about that, you know? So I kind of said, okay, I'm going to back off and say, okay, yeah. I'm going to spend the next few years really digging into this. And as part of my journey, I'm going to ask a lot of questions, even from people I disagree with, you know, or that hold to a different viewpoint. I'm going to, you know, learn why they believe what they believe and leave it at that, you know?
Well, why I asked that question is because I think if someone takes more of an, I don't mean this particularly pejoratively, but if somebody takes more of a culture warrior approach, yeah, where they're, man, I gotta speak up for what's right.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough because obviously there is a place for that. But mm-hmm. the tough thing is when it comes to actual persuasion, I'm not sure for the person who says, I'm going to post X, Y, and Z on Facebook in order to get the truth out there. I'm just not sure how redemptive that is. And but that's part of why I was pressing in. Now, the flip side of that, I'm curious, you've had so many conversations and you're around these subjects. Mm-hmm. What's the best we can hope for? I mean, have you seen people, and how often have you seen people change their minds or their positions? Or are you going into a conversation thinking, listen, I mean, yeah, a win would be a change of position, but honestly, I just hope we can have a conversation and we come out of it saying we respect each other, and that's going to be the win. Do you see people actually change their minds much or change their perspectives?
Yeah. I guess there's two types of change you're probably talking about. One would be a theological change, and another would be maybe a relational or posture change. I've definitely seen a ton of the posture relational change. And to me, that's a huge win.
Yeah.
You know, Bible says, well, follow the way, you know, the road is narrow and so on and so forth. So I of course, you know, a good chunk of humanity is not going to believe what the Bible teaches about this question. So we have to be kind of okay with that. Not like, therefore passive with, but I mean, yeah, I'm not expecting anybody to change their mindset. But I think it's a win if somebody doesn't change their mind on this, that if a relationship can still be maintained and established, I think that's a win as well. I see this a lot with parents with LGBTQ kids, you know. Gosh, those can be really tough relationships. I'm sure you've walked with people
through that.
And so in most cases, there's going to be a belief difference. But I think it's a win if there could be a relational reconciliation, you know, within those differences. I've seen that a lot. The theological change, you know, if somebody was, I would say it's rare, but not non-existent, where somebody was strongly committed to affirming same-sex marriage, that something I said or did or wrote was able to change their theological mind. I've got a few of those stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, I know there's one guy I met. This guy, his brother was gay and a Christian. And it was the straight brother that I met at a conference. He came up and he says, my brother has a message for you. I don't know. Hopefully you can edit this out if you want. My brother has a message for you. F you. I'm like, oh, not the first time I've heard that, but okay. Do you have any? And he's like, well, he's gay and he was affirming until he read your book, and now he's not. And now he's like, all right, well, I either I need to be celibate or maybe enter into an opposite sex marriage, but I no longer am convinced, you know, that same sex marriage is biblical. So, and this is gonna present challenges to me. So the guy said, hopefully you can see by, you know, the brother said it kind of in tongue in cheek a little bit. But I've had a few of those stories. In fact, I can I share this publicly? Yeah, I probably should. I probably shouldn't. I'm sure no one had figured out, but, I've had supporters of my work in ministry that are married to a same sex partner. One transition. She's a trans woman, so biologically male, transition. And we disagree on that, but they so appreciated kind of the manner in which I've gone about it that they support the ministry and everything. Like,
wow.
Those are, yeah, I know, that's what I said. I was like, wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that, I mean, that really is, even if their view hasn't changed proper, that they would be that receptive to what you're doing and creating an atmosphere of civility and respect is really, really cool. How encouraging that must have been for you to have them respond in that way. Wow.
Yeah.
When it comes to just the future of this conversation at Culture at Large, Preston, do you see it largely, I mean, if you were to get your crystal ball out for the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, is there anything that you're seeing when it comes to this conversation that is obviously so difficult and contentious right now? Or do you go, probably just more of the same?
That's a great question. I do have So first of all, I want to make a distinction between LGB and T. Mm-hmm. I know with those terms get collapsed together. So being gay or bisexual or lesbian, that has to do with your sexuality. Being trans, in and of itself, says nothing about your sexuality. It has to do with how you perceive yourself, right, how you identify as. In this conversation, so my point in bringing that up is, I don't see the sexuality side of the conversation slowing down. I think, you know, same-sex marriage, I think it's here to stay. I think more and more people in our society will, you know, continue to believe that that's a very, you know, moral thing. But when it comes to the trans conversation, and I'm getting this from a lot of gay and lesbian people who aren't Christians, you know, I think that there's been kind of an, I think in 2 to 5 years, some of the stuff that it was widespread and popular surrounding the trans conversation will start to pull back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we're already seeing this actually, in various countries and stuff. And already there's a growing animosity between especially older gay and lesbian people and trans identified people. Like there's this idea that it's all one thing is just, it's just a myth.
I mean,
it's, you know, there's organizations, especially in like in the UK called Get the L Out. It's a bunch of lesbians that say, we want the letter removed from this thing because we're not on board with where this has gone. So I do think that some aspects of the trans conversation, the stuff you see on social media that where people highlight kind of the most outrageous forms of this, you know, I just think there's going to be a societal pulling back of that. We're already seeing it. One of the fastest growing organizations is a group called Gays Against Groomers. It's a bunch of secular gay people. They have like 2 million followers or something. I mean, it's crazy. And it's a secular gay movement that is against what they see as like destructive forms of trans ideology, especially as it is grooming kids, is what they would say, you know. And I know that's politically incorrect to use the term groomer. And in no way would I say that all trans people, even most trans people, are groomers. And, you know, I think that term gets thrown around too haphazardly, but that's the name of their organization. And it's grown like crazy.
Huh.
So yeah, I, all that to say, if I, my crystal ball, I think some of the, some aspects of the trans conversation will start to pull back as there's more and more societal, not just conservative, but just across the board societal, people not getting on board with where that has gone. I don't know if you've seen that or.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. And I think, you know, just watching national media in particular, but it is a fascinating thing when it becomes less a largely people of faith versus the culture situation and more a variety of tribes, even within the culture, intention. It's a different dynamic than what we're used to in some of these conversations. Last question I want to ask, and then let you go for the day here, is a lot of your work obviously is dealing with what the scripture specifically says regarding sexuality questions. I'm curious, and you may have resources on this that I've missed, but when it comes to entering into conversations around sexuality from something other than a straight scriptural perspective, or if we don't, because if obviously if you're interacting with somebody who doesn't take God's word to be authoritative, you know, do you start the conversation? Do you work from a natural law kind of a perspective? Is there anybody who's written that you go, you know, this is a really helpful person I would read who maybe doesn't get after it from a straight scriptural viewpoint?
Like argues for traditional marriage without using scripture as an... I would say the best work on this is done by conservative Catholics. There's a book... So Ryan T. Anderson is a conservative Catholic scholar who's done a lot of work in this. I think he has a book, is it What is Marriage? There's another one, I think, Truth Unveiled. So he argues from natural law. He doesn't cite the Bible.
Okay.
And he argues for traditional marriage. And he does probably the best job I can see in that. His tone can sometimes feel a bit culture warrior-y.
Mm-hmm.
So even by saying the name, there's some people who are like kind of turned off because they don't want to do the culture war thing, you know. I've met him several times. He's a wonderful guy, gracious, you know. I can see where people get his tone and they think it's a little too aggressive or whatever in his writing, but I maybe knowing him as a person, I'm not bothered by it, but yeah, Ryan T. Anderson.
Okay.
If you Google him, you'll get some books, and there's others in his sphere that they have done great. Yeah, really good. I do think almost all natural law kind of arguments, you can always find kind of exceptions to the rule, you know? So I think in terms of using those as standalone arguments, I feel like it's always, you know... somebody can always find an exception to the rule that kind of dismantles the argument as a whole, in my opinion. So that's why I actually don't... I think those arguments are good to wrestle with and valid and contribute to the conversation. But I do think without scripture, it's kind of hard to make an absolute moral case. But, you know, some would disagree with me on that.
Well, that's why we just had Bill Mounts on recently. And in part because he's got a great little book just dealing with the reliability and authority of God's word. And I do think, I mean, that is the foundational question for all of this, is where we stand with regard to the Bible. So I hope we can walk with people well in that regard as well. But I just want to say, Preston, it has been such a joy having a conversation with you. And we really do, I said this at the beginning, so appreciate your work. So when you think about all of the, you know, talk about the ratio of affirmations to or appreciation statements to different critiques. I know many around here have said to me so many times, oh, I'm so thankful for Preston. I love the tone he strikes. I love how he writes. And almost assuredly, none of them have ever said that to you. So I want to let you know that you've got a lot of appreciation here in West Michigan. Thanks for taking the time to be on the podcast today, and best of luck in your endeavors. Well, I really, really enjoyed that conversation with Preston. He gives us such a great example of what it means to engage in these difficult conversations in our culture, sometimes within our own families, in a way that is charitable, gracious, and reflects Christ. And so really appreciate that about Preston's example. And I know this came clear through the episode, but please check out his book, his newest book, 21 Conversations. So, so very good. If you enjoyed this podcast, if you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us, as that helps us get the word out about Made to Advance. This has been a production of Engedi Church. We have got more incredible conversations on the way, so follow us on social media if you want to know what is coming up. But until next time, please know you were made to advance.